This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and more with Dr. Fitzalbert Marius of Fresno, California. Born in Panama, he grew up in Harlem. At age 95, he continues to use so many of the amazing skills and talents that included performing heart surgery until just a few years ago. But we never would have seen all those talents emerge if he didn't survive World War II with the 725th Medical Sanitary Company, an all-black unit that followed the 1st Marine Division throughout the Pacific. When we left off, he and seven other men from his unit had disobeyed an order to stay aboard ship and out of Cebu City in the Philippines. They were looking for a little fun and relaxation when Japanese snipers started to fire on them.
And this guy named Arthur was sitting next to me. Now, I'm here and you, Arthur, there, and I'm looking him in the eye. And the snipers opened up and a bullet hit him right in the middle of the forehead and killed him right there with me looking dead at him. Anyway, the rest of us, there were eight of us. We all ducked down and stuff, and we got away from there and returned. Now, we had to report the death. So we reported the death and of course, had to be honest and tell the captain, you know, how we managed to get there in the first place. He didn't put us in the brig, but what he did was this. He turned to me, because I was a corporal at the time, and he said, "Corporal Marius, you are now responsible for alerting his parents of his death." And he put that ethos on me. And it was a tough one because he wouldn't have died if it hadn't been us talking into doing that. So that was one of the closest, you know, because I came across a lot of other things like, you know, bombs and stuff like that and rockets and things like that. But I was very, very fortunate. I didn't get not one injury the whole time. God was looking out for me.
And how hard was that to write that letter to his family?
Oh, man. It was really tough. I would have rather he stuck me in the brig than having to take that accountability. Yeah. Ooh, because, you know, when you're feeling guilty about your accountability in that and responsibility in that situation, and now you got to face a mother that you feel is, you happen to be partly responsible for the death of her son. Oh, man, that was heavy on my butt.
And just hearing you talk about everything else and hearing you process the things that your remarkable life taught you, why do I have a feeling that that incident, that scenario, that real unfortunate incident taught you something?
Oh, naturally it taught me something. You know, let's face it, a lot of the things that you learn comes from the hard mistakes that you made. A lot of things that we do is based upon the experiences that we have gone through. Mm-hmm. So yes, there is no experience that does not has an effect on your affect.
Well, I don't want to pry or put words in your mouth, but with Arthur's death, was the lesson, don't put yourself in those kind of situations? Or what was it?
Well, the situation mostly was telling you, do what is right. Follow orders. You were told to keep your butt on the ship. You did not follow orders, and you're paying the consequence. You pay the price for the choice you make. And I'll say this about me. I have never been one who avoided saying that I'm paying the price. I have never been one who look around and make an excuse and say, well, if so-and-so made me do it. I go and look in the mirror first thing, and I said, Bert Marius, what did you do? Mm-hmm. Because most of the things, even, you know, in my first marriage, you know, my wife there, after 19 years, I got married in July of 1947. If I'd have listened to my mother, I wouldn't have married her. Now, she was a beautiful girl, Dorothy Cottingham. She was a good friend of my sister. And so, you know, just before I went off to the Army, we started dating. I would keep in contact with her, and all of a sudden, I started getting no more correspondence from her. Mm-hmm. And when I got back to America, I found out that she'd, she'd married somebody else. That didn't work for her. She could married him about a year. And by the time I got back, you know, from the armed forces, she was going through a divorce with him and started wanting to redate me again. And so we got together and we started going out. And I went to my mother and told her that we were planning to get married. And my mother, she was always very straightforward. She said, Bert, she's a beautiful girl and nice intelligent, a very nice person, but she's not the one for you. So I said, okay. So I went to my adopted uncle, Dr. Cyril Oliveira, and I asked him. Now, he was always very plain. He said, Bert, he said, now, if I tell you don't marry her, you're going to say I'm keeping you from the most important, greatest thing in your life. Now, if I tell you to marry her and it goes wrong, you're going to blame me. So do what the heck you want to do.
Well, and you mentioned getting home from the war and all that. I don't want to miss anything else about your time in the Army that stands out for you. And I'm curious about those guys that you served with. It's been so long now. How do you think they should be remembered? What was the significance of what you and those other guys did over there? And what do you think the impact of it was?
Well, it was an interesting unit because you only had three men there in the unit outside of the officer, you know, who was white, who had more than a second, third, or fifth grade education. They were from Biloxi, Mississippi, all of that unit except us. Now, my good friend who was from Boston, myself, and this guy, Arthur guy, who was from Chicago, we were the only ones with college education. As a matter of fact, when I found out, I went to the regional commander, and I asked him, was it all right if I started classes to teach them? Most of them couldn't even write or read. So they gave me qualifications to teach them basic fundamental subjects, and they would get credit for it back in America. So I started classes, and a number of those guys hated me because of that. They were saying, because I had I wanted to make them look stupid. But my attitude was not that. My attitude was to teach them, you know, to help them. But they didn't take that attitude. And one of them who claimed he was a preacher of God, we were chopping down trees and stuff in the swamps, and somebody said, look out. And I turned, and this axe was coming towards my head. He was trying to chop my head off. And I had my axe, and I blocked his. And anyway, at that time, I was really tough and strong. And as a matter of fact, after I beat the heck out of that sucker, and I had him underwater and was going to choke him to death, they saved his life by taking my butt off of him. But he wanted to kill me. But then later on, he come wanted to invite me to come to services with him. I said, well, I'm going to services. This sucker wanted to kill me. He called himself. But I taught a number of them how to read and write. But in those days, they weren't as strict. They needed fighting men, and they needed men to do certain jobs, and they didn't give a hoot whether you could read, write, or whatever. Just follow the orders. So, yes, those men needed a lot of help, and, you know, I had a lot of things that I still, you know, based upon the kind of background and traditions that I grew up in among my family, that you be productive. You know, I tried even then to be productive. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I painted a lot of watercolor paintings while I was over there, and I mailed them out and stuff. I have no idea where they are. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't even remember who I mailed them to or anything like that. So I don't know how many paintings I got around anywhere.
What were you painting? What was the subject of those?
I paint the scenery, you know, and the situation. I do a painting, a watercolor painting of a group of men, you know, of national people, you know, whatever.
Where'd you get your painting supplies? I mean, I've had a lot of guys say they couldn't even get food or rations, so how'd you find painting supplies?
You could get painting supplies. Remember, the armed forces had places you could buy things and stuff. They brought those things with them. And, of course, you're in certain places. All these places, you know, when certain cities would have some of those things, you know, they'd have stuff. You could find it.
You mentioned Iwo Jima. When you guys draw straws, the other unit goes in and they're decimated. All but three of them are killed. What about you having to deal with the deaths of people you had come to know? How difficult was that?
Well, you got acclimated to that. It's still the same, you know, people you know and losing is no different then than it is now. Except for the fact is, you know, you have a war attitude that everybody is subject to soon death, including you. That's part of your everyday situation. You wake up, the more you protect yourself and the more you do right, the more potential you have of continuing another day.
And you mentioned that your duties at times included burying the dead. What was that like for you? How difficult was that? How challenging was that?
That was extremely challenging because now you are not talking about burying one or two people. You're talking about getting one of them big ditch diggers and digging out a big trench and then shoving in 100, 200, 300, 1,000 people and then covering them over.
Is that American? Is that Japanese? Is that both?
Both, depending on the situation. Now, with the Japanese, you didn't worry about IDs and stuff like that. But with the Americans, you make sure you got the dog tags off of them so, you know, had identities. But you burying human beings with a bulldozer ain't fun. But you do develop a way of handling it so that you can survive because you have to have an attitude of survival. The Japanese had a way, you know, on some of those islands we were on, they would have big speakers. On the speakers, they'd have a beautiful Japanese woman, you know, and as a matter of fact, it was one girl who grew up here in America, and she went on back to Japan and worked as one of their propaganda thing, yeah, Tokyo Rose. And they'd be playing these blues and stuff. Then they would play a song like, "You had a woman you thought you could trust, but I just found out she's cheating on us." Then they announced, "Why are you colored ones up here fighting against us Japanese while the white man is back there sleeping with your wife?" But we had to learn to ignore. We learned and enjoyed the music and would dance to the music, but we wouldn't ignore what they were saying because we knew it was propaganda, because we knew darn well if they weakened us, they'd come and shoot our butt the same way that they would shoot the others.
If there's anything else about the war years, feel free to mention it. I don't want to miss anything. But when you found out that Japan had surrendered, what was that news like for you?
Well, the news was excellent because what had happened, they had loaded us on a ship. We were heading towards Okinawa. We went through one of them cyclones, and sometimes the ship was up like this. One time the ship like that, we weren't going down, and we all fell right straight down the stairs because we couldn't hold on.
Because the ship's going vertical in these wild waves from a typhoon?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So, and it was during that time they bombed Nagasaki with the atom bomb and so on down the line, and the Japanese surrendered, and we moved away from heading to Okinawa. They headed us right into Japan. We landed in the city of Yokohama. We became part of the Army of Occupation. That was the time where they had that tremendous 8.5 something earthquake in Japan. It caused the tsunami and all that sort of stuff. And that was the first earthquake I ever experienced coming from New York. Yeah. I had never had. And the barracks, I was on the second floor of the barracks, and the barracks was 120 feet long. My bunk was at one end of the barrack, you know, almost down to the other end of the barrack, and I was laying on the bunk on this cot. And this earthquake started and scared the heck out of me. By the time the thing ended, my cot was all the way on the other end, 120 feet away. I hadn't let go. I was holding on to that rascal. And a whole lot of people got killed in that earthquake and stuff like that. And that's where, when I was in Japan, most Americans wanted to force the Japanese to learn to speak English. But I had always been just the opposite. When I was in a foreign land, I liked to learn their language so I could speak. So I made friends with a Japanese professor, former Japanese professor of the University of Tokyo, and I used to go by there every night. He taught me how to speak Japanese. As a matter of fact, after I came back to America, I was able to teach some Japanese students here how to speak their own language because of him. But now, you know, and I still remember some of it, you know, after 60-something years of not even using it because of the way he taught me how to speak that. Now, Filipino language, on the other hand, Tagalog, not so easy, very difficult.
Well, speaking of the Philippines, yeah. That reminds me, I don't think I ever settled with you the end result of that issue in Batangas, where you guys catch word that your own guys are coming your way. Did people die in that clash with the 101st Airborne and your outfit?
Yeah, some people died on both sides, but nothing happened.
Isn't that depressing to realize that you guys wearing the same uniform killed each other?
Well, the whole issue was we were thankful we were still alive, and that's all. We were still over there fighting the war. Not only that, but we still had some enemies. There were groups of people in the Philippines who were as dangerous, attacked you. If you were leaving Batangas and going towards the capital, you had to be careful because those snipers would be shooting at you on the way. You were still at war.
And we're not done with his war story yet, not to mention 55 years as a heart surgeon or his perspective on racial relations in America today. We'll try to squeeze it all in with Dr. Bert Marius when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.